Welcome. We're here. We've taken these trips both here and in your small groups and over lunch. And there's really a joy that I'm feeling. And I want to start with just some simple thank yous, but they really are reflective of a larger gratitude to the community. I want to thank Ellen for taking up her role, and I want to thank Seth and Aram, who have gotten us through the technology of this. You hear that, guys? I want to thank my sustainers. Now, you all know that I've been given two sustainers. And it sort of seems sort of simple. But Marianne, Kate, and I turn around and one of them would be there. And I think that's convenient. But last night, I had very easily physically disoriented. And I came out of one of the small groups after an hour and had to get to the other small group as quickly as possible and found myself turned around on campus. And, of course, no one was around because everybody's in small groups. And I'm thinking, I'm in trouble. And literally, as if on the horizon, a figure starts walking. And I'm looking. And as it comes closer, I realize it's Kata. And I thought, if this is not how sustainers function. On behalf of the collective, I want to thank Dorothy, who's here today and well. And I leave with a new guidance, which is anyone who wakes up from a deep place in a worship service deserves the collective's attention. I thought of this morning as having a spaciousness, and we'll still get some content. We'll still do some work, but it's really a time to begin to take possession of what gifts we've received, what learnings we've had, what struggles we've encountered, and to begin to let our body do its work. These are not only intellectual activities. But they're also, I think, in the language of yesterday, that sometimes we need to close the language door and open the love window. And open the love window, to close the language door and open the love window. And so we will begin to let that process begin. And I woke up thinking about this relationship that has seemed throughout our time together of suffering and joy, is the ecstatic a flight from suffering, or is it something else? Is the ecstatic the experience of a wholeness that can only come from our dealing with the realities of the world we're in and the realities of ourself? In the Jewish tradition, and it's in many mystic traditions, in the Kabbalah, the divine shatters, and pieces and shards of the divine lodge themselves into matter. And our work on this earth is to retrieve the light from those darkest places. And you see that in the work of Jung, who sought to retrieve it from the darkest places inside of ourselves. And you see it in the Quaker tradition, that sought to retrieve it from wherever there was in the world of suffering. And so the mirror for that today is I want to begin with two spiritual allies of mine, a woman named Paula Underwood and a colleague whose name is Lauren Artress. Some of you may know her through her work with The Labyrinth. And then to return, like we did with To Kill a Mockingbird, to look at a scene of great conflict and now begin to tune ourselves to look for where the transformation can begin to take place. How does a field shift? As one person said to me, they're beginning to become aware that each of us can become catalysts in groups. And the way we become catalysts is by bringing the truth of who we are. And because I wanted to let you know sort of where the direction of our hikes are, that we'll end with Ode to Joy, which seemed to be a way of internally bringing all the pieces together. Do I have your permission to continue? Paula Underwood is a clan mother of the Iroquois Nations. My colleague Cheryl Erickson interviewed her shortly before she died. She had been an extraordinary figure in the Native American community, in part because of an agreement made by her great-great-grandmother to keep the oral tradition of 10,000 years alive. She did this in a few different ways. She did it in a book called The Walking People. And she did it through her teachings, through embodying the traditions. And in this interview, Cheryl is asking her about the role of the clan mother. So I'm going to read you a little bit of the intro, similar to what I've just said, and then I'm going to take you into the interview, her words. And you'll hear a question, and that's Cheryl's question to her. Okay? Nearly 200 years ago, an agreement was made and passed down to succeeding generations to keep alive a 10,000-year-old oral history of a people. Paula Underwood was the keeper of an ancient Native American oral tradition handed down from her great-great-grandmother of the Turtle Clan, a member of the five First Nations of the Iroquois. You've probably heard that every decision must be made on the basis of what the impact will be in the seventh generation ahead. Leaders are responsible to feed the mind and the spirit of the people. And you feed the mind with good information. Well, just as the clan mothers are responsible to count the ears of corn and to make sure there is enough to see us through the winter, and indeed through the next three winters, in case the crop is bad next year, so the clan mothers are responsible to feed the mind and spirit. You are chosen as a clan mother for your ability to know the people's heart. So a clan mother is someone who knows how to listen. And she knows how to listen whether anyone's saying something or not, if you see what I mean. How does one learn that? Cheryl asks. When I was a little bitty kitty, about five, my dad began a process. Anytime somebody came and said something to us, my dad would say, "Remember what he said, honey girl?" And I would tell my father what the person said until I got so good at it that I could repeat verbatim long presentations of what the person had said. And he did this all the time. And finally, one day, there was this old gentleman, Richard Thompson, I still remember his name. He lived across the street, and every time my dad started to mow the lawn, here comes Mr. Thompson, and so I would stand out there. Dad says, "You might come and listen to this man, honey girl. He's pretty interesting." And so I listened to him. And then my dad would say, "What did you hear him say?" And I would tell him. Well, eventually, I was repeating all the stories he liked to share with my dad verbatim. I knew them all by heart. And my dad says, "You're getting pretty good at that. Did you hear his heart?" And I thought, "What?" So I went around for days with my ear to people's chests, trying to hear their hearts. Finally, my dad created another learning situation for me by asking my mother to read an article from the newspaper. He says, "Well, I guess if you want to understand that article, you have to read between the lines." I thought, "Oh, read between the lines? Hear between the words?" And the next time I listened to Mr. Thompson's stories, I tried to listen between the words. And my dad says, "I know you know his story. Did you hear his heart?" And I said, "Yes. He is very lonely and comes and shares his memories with you again and again because he's asking you to keep him company in his memories." And it just came out of me. In other words, our heart echoed his heart. And when you can listen at that level, then you can hear not only the people. If you really pay attention, you can hear what the universe is saying. So much of the practice of collective wisdom is to develop this different way of knowing. It's to develop the ability to read between the lines, to hear between the words, and to hear the heart. Now we're going to move to France, Chartres Cathedral. Lauren Artress and a group of her colleagues at Grace Cathedral decide they want to take a trip to Chartres. They have heard of the labyrinth that is there, the sacred geometry. And they get there, and there are chairs all over the labyrinth. It has stopped being used. The way Lauren tells it to me, they basically create a diversion so they can secretly get all the chairs out of the way without being noticed. And while they feared being kicked out, they end up developing a relationship with the people at Chartres and developing a sister relationship between the two cathedrals. And they come and bring the labyrinth back to the Grace Cathedral. And Lauren begins a movement. How many people know of or have walked the labyrinth? It had disappeared for a long time. And now it is in every corner of the world. It's in prisons, it's in hospitals, it's in resort centers. And what moved Lauren, what allowed this to speak through her? And so I'm going to read you part of an interview where she's talking about what the labyrinth meant to her as a symbolic field. And she'll talk about the old mind. And I'm mentioning this now because some people have wondered, what happened to me on Friday? I don't actually remember anything that happened. What is that? Is that a trance? Is that, you know, participation mystique? And I think Lauren has given me some words for what it is we can evoke in groups and the symbolic fields we can create. So I'm going to read you that passage, and this is a section of it, but I'm going to read you the longer passage. An example of the large group spiritual work Veriditas does, which is the organization that she created for the labyrinth, is a pilgrimage we call a moment in time. How do we open ourselves to a transformational moment in time? And of course, the invisible part of this is everybody's going to have a transformational moment in time during the weekend of the gathering. We work very much on an interfaith model, so we use interfaith or universal spiritual language. So referring to the light works well, especially when we hand them a candle at the entryway of the cathedral and the labyrinth is surrounded in candlelight. We limit our programs to around 50, since the labyrinth indoors will hold that many. It is crowded, but not everybody is on the labyrinth at once. There may be 35, maybe 40 people at a time. They begin to create music from the very beginning when we first open the labyrinth. They take the rhythm from the participants. The musicians are actually working in relationship to the movement, the physical movement of the participants. And again, this is a way of bringing in the invisible element. Rhythm, music, pattern, candlelight. All of those help open what Mark Adler calls the old mind. Groups have the potential of opening the old mind much more powerfully than attempting to do it alone. It is difficult to do a spiritual work alone. And of course, once the old mind is open, you can experience the spark of illumination through metaphor, synchronicity, and through events that happen on your journey. There's a paradox there. You can't seek illumination directly, but you can experience it directly through your seeking. There's a paradox there. You can't seek illumination directly, but you can experience it directly through your seeking. That's where magic can happen in groups. I ask, why can't you seek it, spirit, directly? Come on, I want to get there. Tell me. Because it's still under the control of the ego. Do I look here? Do I look there? Maybe this person has the answer. But the answer, the illumination, the moment, the spark of divinity, spark of awareness, may always come in from the side. For instance, one man walking the labyrinth had on a t-shirt with some message like, "You are beautiful." It was a bit quirky, but there he is. And some woman sees this and takes in the message for the first time. She doesn't get hung up on how quirky it is or how seductive it may be under other circumstances. It just goes into her awareness. She is beautiful. You see, the labyrinth is a symbolic field. Sometimes I'll do rituals where people bring a meaningful object and place it in the labyrinth. They won't tell anybody what it is or why they choose it until later. But someone will be working the labyrinth and see this wonderful little charm or bracelet or the I Ching symbol. Whatever it is, it can speak to the intuitive, pattern-seeking part of ourselves. Creating symbolic fields can be a powerful part of group work. So in the event, a moment in time, we actually provide a special moment in time. Now, please understand me. When we're creating around the labyrinth, the intention is not to be manipulative. The intention is to offer a climate of trust, a place of beauty, and an experience for people to truly be walking the path together. It's a profound experience. They receive it on the imagic, non-verbal level. We're on the path together. And one of the things that she has found about the group nature of this work is for all of the profound things people say and want to feel, which in some ways is part of that ego ideal, that what people get hung up on is there's this person in front of me on the labyrinth and they won't get out of the way and I didn't know if I should push her away or I was so impatient. And because it's created a symbolic field, we get to look at that. We could get to look in a different way about what the natural inclinations or the inclinations that have become habitual for us. And it creates an avenue for a new choice. And so much of the small group work, I think, provides in some ways a symbolic field of its own kind to work in. Why am I here? Is this what I expected? Why don't they do it this way? And then there's a moment where we relax. And we realize that this is our opportunity. There was just a wonderful story that came out of one of the small groups about a men's group. And one of the men has lost his key to his truck. And there's all kinds of activity. And they call a tow truck. And they get it all together. You're being men, you know. Oh, I see. It's very funny. And the key is in the door. And I thought, how fantastic. The key is in the door. Not going there. All right, a breath. So we're going to move into this last piece. Like To Kill a Mockingbird, we're going to move, I'm going to give it some framing. But I thought of this actually last night as I was framing it in my mind. It's words from Joseph Campbell. We live in relationship to a system. Is the system going to relieve you of your humanity? Or are you going to use the system for human purposes? We live in a relationship to a system. Is the system going to relieve you of your humanity? Or are you going to use the system for human purposes? Been a theme I think we've started from the beginning of this conference. How do we use ourselves as catalysts? How do we find and see the key to ourselves and what may help release others? And so I'm going to take you into a very conflictual piece. This is from the movie Saving Private Ryan, which some of you have seen. The story takes place in World War II. There's three brothers, the Ryan brothers. This is actually based on a family in upstate New York who were connected to my wife's family. Two of the sons have died, and they're now trying to get the third son out of the theater of war. And a group of people led by the actor Tom Hanks, who's the head of the unit, have to go through trials to find him because they don't know exactly where he is in the theater of war. And they themselves are engaged in warfare and in danger constantly of losing men of their own in this act. And this scene brings to a culmination the frustration and fears that have been accumulating. Each new situation requires Hanks to operate spontaneously on what he thinks the right thing is to do in a situation where chaos has led to no right things. They've decided to take a German encampment that he feels he can't just leave to go and take someone else down. And so he takes his small group to take this encampment, and they lose one of their men. And they capture one of the German men. And now they have to figure out what to do with him. He's a prisoner of war. He should not be killed. He's a burden. He can't be kept. And so you're seeing the scene where this comes to fruition. There has been a theme throughout the movie that the group is wondering who this character Tom Hanks is. What kind of person is he? What was his life like before he became their commander? And they've taken up a pool, all betting on the different occupations he might have. So with that as a context, I ask you to breathe, to allow what we did in the last film, to pay attention to your senses, what you see, what you hear, what you feel. And we will again, with Dixon and George's aid, weave some of our thoughts together with no intent to come to some conclusion, but to see through our collective eyes. What is this moment that the field changes? What are the conditions that allow the field to change? Yes?
Sir. Tell him to march 1,000 paces in that direction. Then he can take off the blindfold. Yes. We'll be gone. And he turns himself into the first Allied patrol he comes across.
You gotta be kidding me. We'll let him go?
There's a POW arriving. Can't take him with us. Our guys will pick him up sooner or later.
Okay. Lucky fresh. Good night. Good night. Let's get it. Show me the owner. Take me off to the boat. Look at him.
Yeah, only if he doesn't get picked up by his own Wehrmacht first and then thrown back into circulation. Captain, you just let the enemy go.
This is such bullshit. You all got that right.
Bullshit. Right, this is bullshit.
Shooting prisoner. Oh,
bullshit,
your mouth.
That's against the goddamn rules.
Yeah, well, the goddamn rules just walked off with your new friend.
But I guess that was the decent thing to do. Okay, Captain?
Get your gear. Let's go.
You heard him. Gear up. Captain just gave you an order.
Yeah. Like the one he gave to take this machine gun. That was a real doozy, wasn't it, Sarge?
Soldier, you are way out of line.
Yes, sir. That was one hell of a call coming to take this nest, but the hell, we lost one of our guys going for it. I swear, I hope Mama Ryan's real fucking happy knowing that little Jimmy's life is a little bit more important than two of our guys. And then again, we haven't found them yet, have we? Have we?
Get the hell off me. Riven, get up. Gear up. Fall in.
I'm done with this mission.
don't you walk away from your captain. Robin, get back in line.
Yes, sir. I'll spend the rest of my life in the stockade if I have to, but I'm done with this.
I'm not going to ask you again, soldier.
Shit. Oh.
You going to shoot me over Ryan?
No, I'm going to shoot you because I don't like you.
Sir,
listen. No, if he wants to go, just let him go.
Are you going
to
shoot me?
Are you letting this happen? Captain! You see this?
Captain. Sir. Ryan's dead.
Bullshit. We have a situation. Bullshit.
You didn't own. Captain, I have a sixth sense about these things. I know it in my bones.
If you don't kill that son of a bitch, Brad, how are you going to shoot me?
Huh? He's better than you.
Then why don't you just do it, Sarge?
Do it, man. Put one in my leg and give me that million.
I'm going to shoot in your big goddamn mouth.
Well, put your money where your mouth is and do it then.
Shut up. You don't know
how to shoot. Pull the trigger already.
Captain, please.
Just a pull on me.
I'll do it. I will do it. You are a coward, son of a bitch!
I'm waiting, sir.
Son!
I'm waiting.
What's the pull on me up to right now?
What's it up to? Wait, is it $300? Is that it? $300? I'm a school teacher. I teach English composition. This little town called Adley, Pennsylvania. In the last 11 years, I've been at Thomas Alva Edison High School. I was a coach of the baseball team in the springtime. Back home, and I tell people what I do for a living, they think, well, now that figures. But over here, it's a big mystery. So I guess I've changed some. Sometimes I wonder if I've changed so much. My wife is even going to recognize me whenever it is I get back to her. And how I'll ever be able to tell her about days like today. Ryan. I don't know anything about Ryan. I don't care. Man means nothing to me. It's just a name. But if... You know, if going to Rommel and finding him so he can go home, if that earns me the right to get back to my wife, well, then that's my mission. You want to leave? You want to go off? Fight the war? All right. All right. I won't stop you. I'll even put in the paperwork. I just know that every man I kill, farther away from how I feel.
Every man, every woman, every human that I kill, the farther away from home I feel. Every harm, every hurt that I do to another human being, the farther away I feel from home, from spirit. It is only when I turn to face and to pick up the dead, my dead, the harm that I have done. Then I feel at home with spirit.
What spoke to me in this scene from this movie, which I have not seen, which I have avoided because of the power of scenes such as this. What spoke to me today is the nature of rapid change of fields that moves so quickly that one has to be very careful to observe it and to move. I find that sometimes I see the opening and I do not take it.
When something comes in from the side, sometimes you're blindsided. And I wrote a book so that people would not be alone. Like I was. So I become connected to the people who are part of my book. So sometimes things that come in from the side are so powerful that we just cannot do it alone.
It can be so simple to subvert a bad system. Maybe not easy, but it can be simple. As we watched Atticus Finch, I remembered that somewhere in a Pendle Hill pamphlet is an episode written about Quakers inviting the Ku Klux Klan to tea and talking to them with respect and with grace, something they weren't used to. And here I am remembered of a writer of theological books who chose to become a Quaker, Walter Wink, talking about the biblical reference to turning the other cheek. He said, it's not if you get abused, just take more abuse. That's not what it's saying. When he goes back and discusses the original context, which I cannot remember exactly, it's about the societal code of behaviors of the time, about what it meant. And in terms of the individuals involved, that it threw aside the societal conventions to a point that the aggressor
would not know what to do in that situation if someone turned the other cheek. It would throw the expected system off so far that it would throw the individual out of his normal field and make him ask why he was doing what he was doing.
It would be very interesting for me to follow this up in some way with real life examples. In the movies, they say things so effectively, so strongly. But when I go back and think, I wish I could kind of go back and look at my life and look at all those highly conflictual situations and see, did something like this ever happen? So in a presentation like this, it would be extremely interesting. And I guess one of those examples is inviting the people, the Ku Klux Klan, to tea. But, I mean, does anybody think of any other examples where something has actually shifted a field like this? Or is this just an incredibly good pattern that is there to inspire us? And I will remember it, and when I'm hopefully in one of these situations, maybe I can use some of this. But I am curious if it's happened to anybody here in real life, or if our speaker has some examples of this in real life.
Thank you. The voice of my workshop leader, I don't know if Stephen's here, there he is in my head, because I remember him saying at the end of every little movement we did, any noticings, which I never heard before, but that's what I'm offering now, is noticings. And one was the dancing we did the first night, the caller from Pittsburgh, was quoting from The Hitchhiker's Guide, "Don't panic. It's only a dance." Well, I dance, so, I'm saying, well, of course. But that's what I was thinking when I was watching this film. How do you not panic? Because those guys were going to kill you. I mean, there was no way that he could back down. And I've been in situations, not with a gun, but, I don't know how to back down. Marriage comes to mind, There's a story there, but we're not going there. But that's it. I have a biblical background, so I remember perfect love casteth out fear. So, that's one avenue. I haven't got it, but it sits there and reminds me. Another noticing is that this college has a seal. It's on the podium, it's on the flags, and it says Libertas per Veritatem, and every 3 years I get to use Latin, so it's freedom through truth. But in the middle, it says John 8:32. So I looked it up in the church across the way, and it's that famous verse where Jesus says, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I add to that what I have heard from 12-step groups, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free, but first it will make you miserable." That's truth, I believe. And then the final noticing for me is thank Marion, and I thank C for making me, get on the path of coming here. But they kept mentioning I mean, it was Anvil. We're going up to Anvil. And I kept hearing it, and there was something in my head when I kept hearing it. And it finally came to me this weekend that, yes, it's Anvil, but it is also an anvil, the forge, for what that's worth. So I'm not answering the previous person's question directly, but I think that the crux of it is in don't panic. And how do you do that? But I think perfect love and freedom.
As it happens, I was in a movement group too, and I've been sitting here thinking, well, actually saying to myself, I noticed so-and-so, and there were two things that I noticed in this, and that was both in To Kill a Mockingbird and this film. I went into To Kill a Mockingbird, it was a child who shifted the field, and in this one, it was a man who works with children. And the other thing I noticed was that both of them started shifting the field by talking about the everyday.
Just in terms of shifting the field, real life, in our small group, I went... When we met yesterday afternoon, people shall remain nameless, but one person was deeply distraught and was ready to leave the group because of pain in their back. And, you know, pain in your back is never emotional. You know that, right? And we sat talking before we started to move, and listening to her story, and I said, well, why don't... She said, what really triggered it for me was the throat singing. And I've heard that from so many people, that people were touching and looking in each other's eyes and singing. And I said, well, why don't we throat sing instead of do yoga? And how would we do that? And I said, well, what do we know about touching and looking in each other's eyes? And we joined knees and hands. And she said, well, I can't stand up because my back hurts too much. I can't sit on the floor because my back hurts. So we sat on benches and we throat sang for about 15, 20 minutes. And the field shifted. And what I would say, I have lots of stories of field shifting in my life, and it's usually when I have taken the ego as far and the intellect right up to the threshold, just as far as it can go and ready to draw a sword, and then I allow the way I stop. I could tell you the story of my last meeting with my architect, but I'm not going to do that to you. But that's what I would say, it is that you have to, you really do trust that there's something greater than your fabulous ego.
There's a natural transition that I imagined, which was from closure of this piece to coming back and inviting the entire community to share their reflections of the conference, its pieces, and its whole. And I think that almost like a gravitational pull, we're moving in that direction. So to bring closure, if there's anything that someone is holding in terms of noticing, then I don't want to move by you, but let's just have a few more, if there are, and then move toward closure only as a way to begin the sharing for the whole community.
Okay. I'd like to be very succinct. my obligation is barricaded, and you look for an open window.
Also, I think what I feel with it is a moving into a silent grounding, and then finding the humanness and coming back to the humanness. And I think if we all look into our own lives, we're going to find times when we find that grounded being and we don't react reactively in the situation. And we move it to another notch. And I think if we look into our mind that.
I was between reason and
confrontation is not that different from defusing a toddler's temper tantrum by simply distracting them.
Us to the next piece. I know this wasn't question and answer, but I do want to actually treat it like question and answer, and the answer is yes. Yes, and yes, and yes, and yes. And again, we are practicing weaving our voices. We are practicing seeing through each other's eyes, seeing how to move from what the associations are to a concentration on a particular third thing, which in this case was the film. And there was just a sense of we were beginning to just peel back layers. And those layers could have kept being peeled back further and further and further. And I particularly want to say yes and yes to the question of, have I had experiences with this or am I making it up? Yes and yes. And if you are left with a curiosity to now pay greater attention to this, then a great achievement has been won among us. And certainly one of my experiences is that this catalytic change is not always up to me. It is my ability to pay attention and see it emerge from the group. And at these points of panic, which so much return us to ourselves. What am I going to say? How am I going to say this? What was that poem I heard 10 years ago? That it's sometimes our ability to release that, as someone was saying, we get to that edge of our ego, we take it as far as we can, and then we let go. And something else can emerge. So as we move toward not closure, because I really viewed my peace this morning blending into the reflections from the whole community, I just want to end on a reflective note. And I think fitting that last night I chose a piece of Rilke's work to talk about what we have been doing to impregnate ourselves with images for the future. You must give birth to your images. They are the future waiting to be born. Fear not the strangeness you feel. The future must enter you long before it happens. Just wait for the birth, for the hour of new clarity. It is, I think, the gift the founders of this conference left us. And it is the gift, I think, existed in this community for further. We're going to end with some music. Maybe take, before I start it, let's move ourselves a little bit into that place. Take a few breaths. Settle yourself in. Food for joy. I didn't say it.